I'll introduce Doug Noland here in just a moment. But I want to welcome you to the McIlvenny Wealth Management Tactical Short Conference Call here April 19th, 2018. And we are this year celebrating our 46th year of operations, the 10th year for the Wealth Management Group as it's currently configured, and we've just passed our first full year anniversary of managing the tactical short, and so we have a lot of exciting things to share with you, not only in terms of what this last year has looked like, but also what we anticipate in the coming months. If you care to mark your calendar as an existing Wealth Management client, our client conference here in Durango, Colorado is September 13th through the 15th. As many of you know, we make an effort to go see you as often as we can, and usually late summer, early fall is when we invite you, if you'd like to meet with our team, sit down with everyone, and not only share meals, but great conversations, and of course the briefings from all of our asset managers. So if you're an existing wealth management client, that invitation is open to you. Mark your calendar, and we look forward to seeing you. Just by way of anticipating the next quarterly conference call for the Tactical Short, we will have the same chat functions as we have here today, and as we move to the Q&A, we'll be looking at not only the questions that you've submitted ahead of time, but if something comes up that you feel is pressing, I'll be checking in on that chat function as well to be able to add those to the list. And if we, for some reason, run out of time, please flag those questions, and we'll come back in a personal conversation and address those with you. But also for next quarter, Doug and I would like to include some charts. So there will be some online functionality, which will allow you to see some of what we're sharing in terms of just raw data and statistics. So rather than trying to take copious notes, which, of course, bear in mind, this is a recorded conference call, so you can go back and listen to it, and there will be transcripts. But if you like the charts as well, that will be in the next iteration for the next conference call. So we've titled this conference call Market Structure, Trump Tariffs, and Higher Rates, Markets at a Precipice. And I want to introduce a couple of those ideas, and then I'll pass the baton to my colleague Doug, and he'll cover where we're at with the tactical short at present and where we're going as well. In terms of the market structure, what we've seen here in the last 2 or 3 months since our last conference call is not only a significant amount of volatility returning to the market after several years of a virtually deadened market where the pulse was barely available to be taken for any of your major indexes. Looking at the volatility index, it basically went to sleep. And, you know, very typical, of course, is when the VIX gets to record lows, that's when everyone assumes that all is well. And sometimes when everyone assumes that all is well, something goes haywire. We had that late in January and early February with the market selling off. Since then, we've had a series of failed rally attempts. And I think this is very critical to hone in terms of market structure, because essentially what those failed rally attempts communicate is that institutional investors are testing for a top. They want to see if they push prices up a little bit, if there's going to be some momentum return, and if there's going to be a resumption of the uptrend in the equities market. And so far, each of those rally attempts has, in fact, failed. So we had the primary peak in January, the secondary peak at a lower level in March, which again speaks to the energy or lack thereof in the equity markets today. Not picking on any particular index here, but actually true of all of them. And very telling, if you're looking at all of these indexes, is that the majority of these rallies have been on weak volume. So ordinarily, you would want to see a robust return, a robust resumption of an uptrend with the audience for equities growing with greater enthusiasm. And I think the operative word here is tepid. The majority of the rallies have been on weak volume and very telling in terms of distribution trends is that each of the sell-offs has been on increased volume, again, which would suggest that we are in distribution phase. And while we've been testing for a top, there's enough people who are actually getting out of the markets and using each rally as a means of moving to the sidelines. January, it was interesting. We had, of course, the peak in ETF purchases and public buying of the major indexes, what we would call capitulation buying. You know, folks who had been on the sidelines and they just couldn't take it anymore. They had to get in the stock market. They had to own something of the American dream, the uptrend. Everybody seemed to be making money. And so there we had sort of a last mad dash into equities. And we saw that with very dramatic fashion. If you're looking at the funds that were coming into the exchange-traded funds, in particular, your low-cost ETFs were just blowing up record numbers on a weekly and monthly and quarterly basis. A few things to look at. Again, this all in the category of market structure. Here in recent days and weeks, we're seeing a divergence between the financials and one sector, of course, within the S&P 500. That divergence is a negative divergence. The financials are moving lower, while the S&P 500 has been holding its own or moving higher. And the financials, you know, it used to be said that they led the market either on the upside or the downside. Just keep an eye on that divergence and see if it continues to widen. If there's a yawning difference between the two, then odds are the markets follow lower. And that's interesting because I think it coincides with a seasonal bias, which is coming to a close here. We've got options expiration this Friday. And with that behind us and the good 6 months out of the year behind us as well, where you typically see funds come in for retirement assets, 401ks, IRAs, the funding, which is sort of November, classically November through mid-April in tax season, the good 6 months are behind us. So a number of things for us to consider in terms of market structure and Doug will, of course, expand on that as well. In the category of Trump tariffs, we're fascinated. We're fascinated to see, the U.S. press for some advantages, and they've gained some advantages. We'll talk in detail about that in a little while. But you've got Germany and you've got Europe as a whole, along with China, which are stalling economically. And you see the PBOC, the People's Bank of China, and the ECB are again trying to gin up the financial system. This week, the PBOC lowering the reserve requirements for banks, the ECB going back into balance sheet expansion mode. The ECB balance sheet, they're monetizing debt again, and as of this week, they hit a new fresh high, 4.548 trillion euros. And so, again, there's some issues as it relates to the tariffs, but it's with a backdrop of growing concern economically. U.S. economy, we're getting some decent statistics. I mean, you could pick on some areas of weakness in retail and in housing, but you could offset those with some positive statistics as well. Doug's long made the case that there is a difference between the economy and the financial system, and we are seeing sort of cracks within the financial system. So the tariffs, again, this is for us an opportunity for Trump to press an advantage when our global trade partners are somewhat constrained. There's not a lot that they can do. And the bigger picture, if you've read some of Doug's comments in recent weeks in the Credit Bubble Bulletin, which I would encourage you to listen to read routinely on a Friday evening, Saturday morning drumbeat. The Trump tariffs and the tariffs in general are a part of geopolitical deterioration. And this is, I think, the bigger issue. If you're looking at global e-commerce, China is taking on a larger and larger role. 10 years ago, they were 1% of global e-commerce. Today, according to the World Economic Forum, they're 42%. The U.S. was 35% of global e-commerce. We're now 24%. In terms of a breakdown of global GDP, if you look at the entire Asian bloc, include India and China in that, the entire Asian bloc is 33.8% of global GDP. North America is 27.9%, Europe 21%. And PricewaterhouseCoopers suggests that over the next 20 to 30 years, this is going to be revolutionary, with China becoming number one, India becoming number two, and the U.S. becoming number three. Now, I don't know that I fully agree with PricewaterhouseCoopers on some of the finer points of their argument, but what's at stake here is a global leadership role. And so when you look at the trade tariffs, this is sort of one part of a bigger issue, and it is global leadership, and it is U.S. hegemony, and it is the role that we've played as the world's reserve currency. So these are the things that are in play, with the big question being who will lead in the 21st century. The last part of our title today is higher rates, and this is where you look at the total stock of debt and recognize that higher rates, that's one area where if you can control the rate of interest, you can continue to expand the debt. Alternatively, if you can grow your economies, that economic boost and the growth from that activity can go a long way towards supporting greater amounts of debt. I would argue that the scales are a little bit off here, and that with any increase in interest rates, we've got room for destabilization within the bond market and the whole financial markets as a whole. Go back 10 years, and so one decade ago, we had very different debt figures. We entered into the global financial crisis roughly 10 years ago, and it was a financial issue with there being too much debt and too much creative finance in the system. Total debts globally today are $237 trillion. That's $70 trillion more than we had a decade ago. For the $70 trillion in additional debt that we have globally, we've gained $21 trillion in global GDP. So, again, just rolling back the clock, we were at $63 trillion in global GDP. Now we're at 84. That's the estimates for 2018. And debt, again, we've added $70 trillion to that. So, again, dollar for dollar matchups, we had that, in the 70s and 80s, we began to see some inefficiency in terms of more debt and less economic growth generated by that debt. It's become more inefficient as time's gone on. The U.S. is at $2.10 in new debt for every dollar in economic growth. That's been the case over the last 10 years. So we've added $5 trillion to GDP. We've added $10.5 trillion to our national debt. That's just U.S. government debt, not talking about the rest of the mix, $65 trillion in that U.S. pot. But where it's really confounding is globally, $3.33 in debt for every dollar increase in GDP. And what it really suggests is that we've got a battle ahead. We thought we had a battle, and that was somewhat behind us, getting rates to the zero bound. And now we've got the talk of normalization. Now we've got balance sheets, which are going to be shrinking, right? Except the ECB, which I'd mentioned just a moment ago, it's not shrinking, it's back to expanding. But we're on a schedule here in the U.S. to shrink our balance sheet. What does that mean? That means we're taking assets that are on the balance sheet, we're bringing them back into the market on the assumption that there is a hunger for those assets, that they're going to be absorbed. The challenge is we're running larger and larger budget deficits at the same time. bottom line is, at least for the U.S., it implies that we're going to have to find people to fund an extra $1 to $1.5 trillion in government debt this year. And that's possible, but we'll see how that is reflected in the interest rate environment. So just this is a bit of an introduction to those three things: market structure, the tariffs, and higher rates, some of their implications. Again, we're dealing with a mountain of debt, and now with interest rates beginning to creep up here in the U.S. and around the world, you have to ask the question, what are the implications into the financial markets with there being multiples of debt, even from what we had in the global financial crisis circa 2008 and in 2009. So I want to hand things over to Doug, and he can take us a little bit further into the tactical short, how we're structured, and then once he's done with his comments, and I might interject something to a little bit more on the geopolitical here in a few minutes, but then we'll transition to Q&A and spend the rest of our time in Q&A.
Great. Thanks, David. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for taking the time to jump on today's call. As always, special thanks to our account holders. We hold dearly the relationships we're developing. And for new listeners that may be unfamiliar with Tactical Short, we have detailed information available at mwealthm.com/tacticalshort, and that's all one word, Tactical Short. Let me begin with a brief overview. The objective of Tactical Short is to provide a professionally managed product that reduces the overall risk in the client's total investment portfolio while providing downside protection in a global market backdrop with extraordinary uncertainty and escalating risk. This strategy is designed for separately managed accounts, or SMA. We'll short securities, stocks, ETFs. We'll also on occasion buy liquid listed put options. We continually gauge risk versus reward on each individual position. Shorting entails unique risk. Our job is to remain keenly focused on managing risk. This sets us apart from others. We tactically adjust our short exposure. We expect to generally target exposure between 50 and 100% short. Our maximum short exposure in 2017 was 36%. Exposure was at 18% at the time of our January 18th conference call. Currently, short exposure is targeted at 60%, and I'll have more on exposure in a few minutes. We see tactical short as an integral component, let's say a 5 to 20% allocation within a well-diversified investment portfolio. We don't recommend big bearish bets against the stock market. We instead believe it's time to refocus attention on risk and disciplined risk management. We expect to see environments where we'll be opportunistic, seeking outsized returns, but generally this strategy will endeavor to have less volatility, a lower portfolio beta than the U.S. equities market. My career managing short exposure dates back to 1990. I'm feeling pretty old these days. Tactical short is unique, offering in the marketplace. We're convinced we've structured a better mousetrap when compared against other hedging products. We structured tactical short differently. We wanted to ensure flexibility to navigate through even the most difficult market conditions. And I'll repeat what I've stressed in previous calls. Remaining 100% short all the time, as most short products are structured, is risk indifference. And risk indifference on the short side doesn't work. Few products suggest short exposure based on changing risks and opportunities. We know it's imperative to do so. I'll update performance. Tactical short accounts after fees gained 0.24% during the first quarter. The S&P 500 returned a negative 0.76%. The strategy now has one-year performance numbers from our April 7th inception date through April 6, 2018. Tactical short returned a negative 2.74% versus the S&P 500 that returned a positive 12.62%. We regularly track our performance versus three actively managed short fund competitors. The Grisma Short Fund, they lost 1.39% during the first quarter. And they have a one-year number ending April 6th, that a loss of 13.25%. Ranger Equity Bear made 5.36% in the first quarter. Their comparable one-year number is a loss of 7.26%. The Federated Prudent Bear Fund gained 0.32% during Q1. Their comparable one-year number is a loss of 10.88%. We benchmark performance versus the inverse of the S&P 500. In our first year of operation, tactical shorts 2.74% decline was about 22% of the inverse of the S&P 500's return, significantly outperforming our competitors. I'm not overjoyed with performance, but we've navigated satisfactorily through a quite challenging period. So let's take a deeper dive into 2018's first quarter, a remarkable period in many respects. The S&P 500 returned 7.55% through January 26th, through that all-time high. After ending February 1st at 28.22, the S&P 500 abruptly traded down 10% to an intraday low of 25.33, just six sessions later on February 9th. From that trading low, the S&P 500 then rallied 10% to trade within 3% of all-time highs in mid-March. NASDAQ posted all-time highs on March 13th. Selling returned into quarter end. Candidly, this is the type of market volatility I dread the most. Wild volatility creates challenges for managing the tactical short strategy. In a strong market backdrop, we can hunker down and focus on wealth preservation. If it's a weaker market environment, we'll build short exposure and be more opportunistic. But going from melt up to the brink of meltdown in about a week's time presents quite a management challenge. Speculative market dynamics through much of January dictated a focus on risk management and capital preservation. During January's conference call, we were asked why short exposure was not at zero. And I'm sure some are questioning why we weren't better able to capitalize on an abrupt 10% market decline. I believe strongly and our risk-focused strategy, and my first priority is to avoid outsized losses. Tactical short began the year with targeted short exposure at 22%. Short exposure was down to 16% by January 21st. We reversed course and began building short exposure the following week, and we're up to 24% by the time of the February 5th market downdraft. The bottom line is we had limited time to boost short exposure. I subscribe to a disciplined investment process where we add exposure incrementally when we see confirmation of our fundamental thesis. We're not in the business of placing big bets on short-term market direction. I'm a longtime bike rider, and over the years, I've made analogies between biking and managing short exposure. There are disciplines. Keep firmly a hold of the handlebars. Your head stays up, remain steady and alert, and definitely avoid abrupt movements. That is, unless you find yourself in harm's way. If a truck's suddenly coming right at you, you'll take your chances and put you and your bike down in a ditch. It's always the most fun flying down hills, but you risk losing control. You sacrifice flexibility, just as risk is expanding exponentially. The key is maintaining a disciplined focus on identifying possible hazards. And the faster you travel, the more difficult it becomes to recognize approaching risks. Granted, it may not be as fun and as exciting, but you can have a rewarding long ride if you avoid crashing and burning. My goal is to ride my bike and manage short exposure. Hopefully for some of you, when I'm 75, I'm done flying down hills. But back to the extraordinary first quarter, we ended March at 52% short. I'll discuss a few of the key market developments during the quarter. First, there was the blow-up of the so-called short vol strategies, a major development from the standpoint of my analytical perspective. Almost a decade of unprecedented central bank monetary stimulus and market support created the perception that security prices only go up. And there's been no surer way to generate strong returns than by riding various forms of market protection, selling flood insurance during the drought. The Credit Bubble Bulletin begins each year with a focus on key issues for the upcoming year. I titled this year's piece, Issues 2018, Market Structure. Serious and, you know, I would argue, epic market structural shortcomings have accumulated over this prolonged period of ultra-loose financial conditions and associated market excess. There's been a proliferation of sophisticated derivative strategies that are variations of selling market protection. There's a $4 trillion-plus ETF complex, which is essentially a bullish bet on market direction, and it's untested through a complete market cycle. There's also the $3 trillion-plus hedge fund industry that is crowded into risk-on strategies incorporating aggressive risk-taking and, as always, leveraging. During the eruption of extreme market instability, markets experienced extraordinarily high correlations across asset classes and across international markets. This was important confirmation of the unparalleled nature of synchronized securities bubbles. This extraordinary global backdrop, the proliferation of derivatives, crowded trend following trading, the leveraging, and all the rampant speculation points to unprecedented market liquidity, vulnerability, and latent fragilities. Some of these latent risks started bubbling to the surface during the first quarter. I've drawn parallels between the February blowups of the short volatility funds and the collapse of the Bear Stearns structured credit funds back in the early summer of 2007. This amounted to the initial crack in the mortgage finance bubble. The subprime eruption proved the beginning of the end. It was a historic inflection point for risk-taking, leveraging, and marketplace liquidity. Recall, however, that it took about 15 months of unstable markets to evolve into a full-fledged financial crisis. During the first quarter, we saw the arrival of a new Federal Reserve chairman, Jerome Powell. He's not an academic. He's not wedded to arcane theory, rigid economic doctrine, or dubious econometric models. I even suspect he's not an inflationist. Powell has been skeptical of the benefits of QE and appreciates the risks associated with activist policymaking. I believe Chairman Powell will direct a regime change at the Fed. The FOMC will show more determination in pursuing policy normalization, subtly backing away from experimental policymaking. Our central bank will be less eager to coddle the stock market. Going forward, the Powell Fed will be cautious in redeploying QE. This implies risk, less certainty with respect to the so-called Greenspan, then Bernanke, then Yellen market put that has underpinned markets for three decades. CPI ended the quarter at 2.4% year over year, with core CPI up 2.1%. Even the FOMC doves are now calling for gradual rate hikes. 10-year Treasury yields have jumped 50 basis points so far this year. They closed today 2.91%, getting close to that 3% hurdle. 2-year yields are up 56 basis points year to date. The first quarter witnessed a notable dimming of the Treasury market's safe haven status. In general, fixed income registered losses for the quarter. Junk bonds suffered large outflows at times, and even investment-grade credit showed vulnerability to destabilizing ETF outflows. So-called risk parity and other sophisticated strategies, many incorporating leverage, showed vulnerability to the shifting market landscape. David, I'll send it back to you.
Well, again, we titled this call, Market Structure, Trump Tariffs, higher rates, markets at a precipice. And of course, we have a question mark there. But, you know, when you look at market structure, what was exposed here in the first quarter are a number of serious issues. And I think one of the things that we've got to recall is how quickly market liquidity vanished. It's there in abundance, and everyone assumes it's there, and then literally vanishes overnight. We had that on display here in the first quarter. In terms of geopolitical risk, that becomes a very pressing issue for global markets, and arguably we've reached a critical juncture during the quarter. It's important to appreciate that bubbles are at their core mechanisms that redistribute and destroy wealth, and we've witnessed these powerful dynamics and some very dire consequences with the mortgage finance bubble and its aftermath here a decade ago. We're today in the throes of arguably the greatest global bubble in history. So with that in mind, geopolitical risk becomes a central issue and a part of our analytical focus and of Doug's work on a day-to-day basis. The president's tariffs and the aggressive approach with protectionism and trade relationships, that does become a market issue. We had the introduction of the 25% steel and aluminum tariffs. Of more consequence is the administration launching formal attacks on China's trade practices. China is a major issue, and it's an unfolding major issue. The focus thus far has been on the trade deficits with China. The China issue goes beyond that, goes beyond unfair trade. There's the theft of intellectual property, there's corporate and military espionage, there's China's state objective of technological superiority, hacking and cyber warfare, military buildup, which is happening just in the last 2 weeks. We had communication jamming devices, which were successfully installed in the Spratly Islands, and they're in the Taiwan Straits, the largest ever show of naval force, with 5 live-fire military drills, again, there in the Taiwan Straits. It's an extension of power and influence in the region and ultimately globally. We hold the view that China's forceful pursuit of status, of superpower status, is an overarching issue. You've got President Trump that believes that the U.S. has, over the years, aided and abetted our competitor. And China's ascension of financial and economic and military power, he believes that a tougher stance by the U.S. is long overdue. That's what our president is taking us into, is that tougher stance. So tariffs and trade sanctions are sort of the opening salvo. There's going to be modest concessions, but the reality is you're dealing with a strong man toe-to-toe with another strong man. You know, President Xi is not prone to backing down. So we would expect U.S.-Chinese relations to sour, to continue this hour. We have deteriorating relationships with China, along with China's strategic partner, Russia, and that creates a new sort of Cold War backdrop with unfolding negative ramifications for international markets and the global economy. If you recall, the capital flow constraints, which were prevalent prior to the early and mid-90s, capital controls were all too common throughout Europe and around the world. And as you saw capital controls eliminated and the free flow of capital across borders, you began to see the global economy move into overdrive. You bring back these Cold War backdrop dynamics, and all of a sudden there's some flow constraints. And flow constraints are a bit of an issue. So we're increasingly concerned with China's aggressive military posture in the South China Sea and with Taiwan. We expect a more aggressive Putin, and sanctions are biting into the Russian economy. We had last week's missile attacks in Syria, which absolutely had a broader audience. This was not just about Assad, but the fact that we included B-1s in the mix and could have had 40 times the amount of firepower thrown from those heights suggest that we were speaking to Putin, we were speaking to the Chinese, we were speaking to Iran, we were speaking to North Korea, a much, much broader audience. But we should be aware that a cornered bear is never an animal to tangle with. And in fact, that may be what we're doing with Putin, is putting him in an uncomfortable corner. Trump's tariffs, they mark a critical juncture geopolitically. Doug, I want to hand this back to you, but this is an insecure world now dominated by strongman leadership. And these are headstrong leaders, and they're increasingly butting heads. You've got geopolitical storm clouds darkening here in the first quarter. And to be quite frank with you, markets have largely ignored or brushed off these geopolitical factors. Anyways, my two cents. Back to you, Doug.
Thanks, David. So for the question, are markets at the precipice? Very serious market structural issues have been illuminated in derivatives and hedging strategies and in marketplace liquidity. We saw all of that in the first quarter. The cost of hedging risk has begun to increase. Financial conditions have begun to tighten. Market yields are rising. Global interbank lending rates have been rising briskly, getting some attention. Risk premiums have begun to widen across the risk markets globally. Investment-grade credit is showing vulnerability. That another rough day in the marketplace today. Looking globally, overall Chinese credit growth has begun to slow, which is a major development, while their mortgage and consumer bubble excesses continue to worsen. These tariffs and trade wars are now a real and present risk to the markets. The Fed has become more determined to actually implement a tightening of monetary policy. Monetary policy has begun the process of normalizing globally. The ECB will be winding down its QE over the coming months. Washington politics are in disarray, and the midterms are about 6 months away. And there are political scenarios that would be very disruptive to the markets and to the entire country. Even in a boom time environment, the social mood is bitter, divided, and anxious. As David highlighted, geopolitical risk is now escalating rapidly. So in our view, the risk versus reward calculus for being short has become more favorable, and we have increased short exposure accordingly. The risk of being short remains high, though, so we are carefully managing our short exposure. As is typical at market tops, the economy appears strong and earnings robust. Superficially, things do look okay. They looked much better than okay back in 2007. The problem is that markets, and that's equities and fixed income, have become a historic bubble. And this bubble has been fueled by unprecedented monetary and fiscal stimulus. Treasury just reported that the federal government posted a $600 billion deficit just in the first half of the fiscal year. Fiscal policy is now completely out of control. A downturn will see deficits absolutely explode. Short-term interest rates, along with market yields, remain significantly below what would be appropriate for this late stage of the boom cycle. I believe risk markets have been in a historic topping process with all the makings for an unfolding bear market. And tops are never easy. This one is of the super cycle variety. So I see overwhelming support for the bubble thesis. The finance fueling this extraordinary global boom is unsound and highly unstable. There are fragilities festering just below the surface. Markets have turned hopelessly speculative. They're short-term focused and incapable of adjusting for mounting risks. The year is certainly off to a wild start. Instability appears poised to continue in the markets, in Washington, and geopolitically. Markets have experienced their initial bout of instability. Typically, it's the next sell-off that risks turning into a serious issue. If money comes flying out of ETFs, the hedge funds de-risk and deleverage, and those on the wrong side of derivative trades move to hedge, I question who will step up and provide the necessary liquidity to accommodate such massive selling pressure. Reiterating our key message, the It's time to refocus attention to risk and discipline risk management. David, I'll send it back to you for Q&A.
The questions we have, I've got a few coming through on the chat function, so feel free to keep on sending those, and we'll get started also with the ones that were submitted ahead of time. The first of which is, how many dollars, what do you need to start with the tactical short? And for institutions, it's $1 million. For an individual investor, it's $100,000. So slightly different audience in both cases. But as Doug mentioned, we've set up the SMA structure to be able to somewhat customize that to risk mitigation needs within an individual portfolio. So institutional accounts, $1 million. Individual investor accounts, $100,000. Let me direct this next one to you, Doug. In what percentage terms do you see the coming market capitulation taking place? Could we see a 50% or greater correction based on the current leverage in the system?
Sure. Yeah, that's a good question. During my career, I've seen two bubbles burst, both leading to 50% stock market declines. My view is the current bubble has inflated much beyond the previous two. So I would expect a greater than 50% decline, although this might unfold not as quickly. It might unfold over several years, perhaps. And unlike the previous bust episodes, I believe policy responses the next go-round will be more limited. Monetary policy is already loose. We're well on our way to trillion-dollar deficits. I also suspect that QE will prove much less effective next time. The bond market in particular may be less willing to accommodate all the QE. There's an important dynamic that goes unappreciated these days. Not only has this bubble expanded across asset classes, and it's gone global, it has also gone to the heart of contemporary money and credit. It's gone to central bank credit and government debt. Back in 2009, I began referring to the risk of a global government finance bubble. Somewhat later, I referred to it as the granddaddy of all bubbles. This has gone on much longer and become more dangerous than I suspected. The danger is that a decade of policy excess risks a crisis of confidence at the very foundation of global finance. If you recall back, the 2008 crisis was chiefly a crisis of confidence in private sector debt, private sector obligations. I fear the next crisis will encompass private as well as public sector debt, which would be a much more difficult crisis to manage, definitely more problematic backdrop to initiate another central bank reflation. With this in mind, I believe the next crisis has huge unappreciated downside, with ultimate market lows perhaps some years into the future.
So 50% is a real possibility. Let me ask the next question, which is, if the U.S. dollar crashes and the Fed pours more money into the markets and we go more into a hyperinflation than it seems, perhaps that the S&P 500 would go up because the markets are being fed by more and more money. It seems that in that case, short or bear funds could continue to go down, as they have since 2008, as we've witnessed a rise in prices. Your comments?
Right. I would expect any meaningful pickup in inflation to be quite problematic for the bond market, and I think there's a lot of leverage in the bond market. I think it's vulnerable. A hyperinflation does imply an acute crisis of confidence in the dollar, which would be extremely destabilizing for the U.S. debt markets and U.S. equities as well. The data is troubling. Foreign holders have amassed huge positions in U.S. financial assets, and there are major derivative issues as well. The world's seen a massive inflation over the past 10 years, most of it directed at securities and asset markets. I believe myself, the bigger near-term risk is a collapse in asset bubbles rather than a major inflation outbreak. Hyperinflation could unfold over time in the next post-crash monetary inflation, but I'm kind of hesitant to try to predict too far ahead. The key for us will be to adjust the level and composition of our short exposure. When we see major developments start to unfold, we'll want to carefully target where we're short. There'll be more enticing short opportunities in a market index. We'll always remain diligent in monitoring and adjusting to policy responses and other macro forces generally. Hopefully we'll navigate through this much better than bear products have navigated over the last decade.
I'm going to blend three different questions that have just come in from the chat online function. One, how do you prioritize hedging strategies in this climate? Two, is there anything I can do to hedge my 401k or traditional IRA? And the third is, if I cannot, because of the percentages provided, 5 to 20%, allocate $100,000 to the tactical short, again, back to the how do you hedge in this climate? I'll take a stab at this, Doug, and if you want to add anything, feel free.
Right.
There's very few products that are provided for within a 401k. So you would have to do most of your hedging elsewhere and look at your portfolio on a holistic basis. Inside of traditional IRAs, the tactical short, we can actually manage a comparable strategy inside a traditional or Roth IRA. And it's not exactly like a cash account because there's some functionality which is just not allowed by the IRS within those structures. But we do have a comparable product for traditional IRAs. Prioritizing hedging strategies in this environment, if that $100,000 minimum is not an option, my encouragement to you is to look at what has been sort of a countercyclical hedge through the years. When stocks are not doing well, precious metals tend to do very well. And when stocks are doing very well, precious metals tend not to. So if we are at an inflection point and you wanted to hedge, even by having, say, $5,000 or $50,000 or $75,000 of a hedge, you could do that. And I think I would rather do that than even choose some of our 100% short all the time competitive products. Doug, any thoughts, or you want me to move to the next one?
Yeah, those are good thoughts. I concur, David. We'll move to the next question.
Right. What, in your view, on that inflation deflation debate regarding today's market, what is your view? And is there too much credit or debt in the system for inflation to be a significant threat?
Yeah, this is a really good question. And it's an important analytical issue, no doubt about that. I've always argued that the inflation versus deflation debate is too simplistic. And, this debate has been going on now for decades, it seems. I subscribe to the Austrian economics view. There are all different types of inflation, consumer price inflation just being one of them. There's asset inflation, over malinvestment, overconsumption, trade deficits. Those are all part of excess monetary inflation. For many years now, this massive monetary inflation has led to inflation in securities markets, real estate, and the value of private enterprise. And let's not forget about the massive investment in manufacturing capacity in China and throughout Asia. We now have these bubbles globally, many of them in danger of bursting. So I would argue that the most important issue is not inflation or deflation, at least today it's not, but these historic bubbles that have inflated. And going back 30 years, all the way back to the 1987 stock market crash, and too many times since then, we've seen the Fed and central bankers repeatedly adopt aggressive stimulus measures to fight the so-called scourge of deflation. But this has only ensured bigger and more comprehensive bubbles. They're kind of fighting a losing battle there. And back to the question, is there too much debt in the system for inflation to be a threat? Well, this amount of debt will limit options, no doubt about that, come the next crisis. There is a risk of a systemic crisis of confidence in all financial assets, the way this is unfolding.
A question that's of a practical nature: can a resident of Canada participate in the short program, and what concerns are there for international customers if you accept them. Unfortunately, Canadian residents, citizens living in Canada, we cannot open accounts for at this time. Another question relating to sort of the structure of the fund, what annual fees are there and what percentage do you take of profits if earned? While we do operate with the flexibility of a hedge fund, we decided that we wanted to structure ourselves in a way that was different than hedge funds and have a very simple fee structure and not participate in the profits earned. So your normal 2% and 20, which is common in the hedge fund community, 2% for management and 20% of gains, is not how we function at all. We just decided a simple 1% fee on assets under management is how we would operate, and that represented for us the best way to partner over a long period of time with clients, keeping our incentives aligned with our clients in a way that was I think palatable over the long term. Just one other note, the Tactical Short conference call today will be downloadable. So in sort of a podcast form, you'll be able to get that. And here in the next 3 to 4 days, also, you'll have transcripts for it. Doug, next question for you. What signals will you rely on to determine if a full bear market is underway? And will the short fund use leverage at that point?
Sure. The term bear market generally refers to a 20% market decline, so it's kind of a technical indicator. My overriding focus is always on financial conditions. More specifically, it would be marketplace liquidity, credit conditions, risk embracement or risk aversion in the markets. Are speculators increasing leverage or reducing it? And I have a mosaic of indicators I follow diligently. I view the hedge fund industry as the marginal source of marketplace liquidity. So is speculative liquidity expanding or contracting? That's a critical issue for my framework. I generally incorporate periphery and core analysis, expecting to see incipient signs of tightening of financial conditions at the periphery. And that's, for example, in junk bonds, the emerging markets, small cap stocks, subordinated bank debt. And once I see early indications of tighter finance, I want to gauge how it's gravitating toward the core. It's at the core where these issues become more systemic, so that's vital. But every cycle has its nuance, every bubble is different. I would argue that this type of analysis is as much an art as it is a science, and always a challenge. I would argue some of the greatest excesses throughout this protracted cycle have been at the so-called core. For example, there's been enormous speculative flows, especially through the ETF complex, that have fueled bubble dynamics in the S&P index and in investment-grade corporates. I believe the most egregious derivative excesses and associated leverage, those are right there in the arena of big-cap U.S. equities and corporate credit indices. So these areas will continue to be monitored closely for incipient instability, which we started to see that in February. To the leverage question, we will not have actual short positions more than 100% of our account value. So in that sense, we will not use leverage, but we'll certainly consider listed put options that would lift our overall exposure to the market. Mainly, we want to be in the right stock sectors and indices that are underperforming the general market. And over time, we hope to build good performance by being in the right places and avoiding outsized losses. That's always key to our strategy.
With what is going on in the markets, what do you see as the future for gold now and going forward into 2019? That's the next question. I'll take that. Just briefly, 2017 had record exchange-traded fund purchases of gold, second highest on record. So go back to 2011 and 12 when gold was 1900. The kinds of inflows that we were seeing then, we're seeing a return to interest by investors both in Asia and in Europe. I can tell you frankly that in the U.S., There's very little interest, and I think that is a reflection of interest in equities and a distraction by the equities market. Equities had a dead decade here in the U.S. From 2000 to 2010, stretch that to 11, you had the Dow, the S&P, basically you had no returns for that decade, and gold did exceptionally well, north of 10, almost 12% annualized returns in gold. And I think moving forward, to the degree that we see a crack in the stock market, the U.S. investor will join the bandwagon and get on board with the Asian and European investor who has already seen something change and has already begun to position for higher prices in the gold and silver markets. So a very positive outlook for 2018 and 2019 in the precious metals, and it is somewhat commensurate with a decline in stocks, at least insofar as U.S. investors then have extra motivation to find growth elsewhere. The next question, how Doug, will you position the portfolio to benefit from the moves the Exchange Stabilization Board will make to stabilize the market volatility?
And I'm not sure about the Exchange Stabilization Fund, but let's think of policy responses more generally. And, you know, as I've done in the past, I will carefully monitor, extensively monitor policy responses. And there'll be times when we reduce short exposure and expectation of Federal Reserve market support. That's just going to be part of what we'll have to do. We may use options to partially hedge against the risk of a market rally. As I've done throughout my career, we might also consider long positions that we would expect to benefit from reflationary measures, certainly including gold and the precious metals. There will be environments where we see short risk escalating. In the past, I've lowered short exposure. I've avoided higher beta stocks, as well as stocks and sectors with large short positions. I've liquidated, put holdings in front of expected policy moves, and basically de-risked ahead of various policy responses. You know, this is a very challenging aspect of what I do, but at the same time, it's a necessity on the short side.
So if long-term interest rates begin to rise due to market forces, what would that cause a worldwide trend of deleveraging of all sorts of debt, not to mention defaults? If this were to occur, would the U.S. dollar become in the short term more valuable to hold?
A couple of thoughts come to mind. First, we're now into decades of trade and current account deficits. We've basically flooded the world with dollar balances. The rest of the world now holds $27 trillion of U.S. financial assets, and that's from the Fed Z1 report. And that includes $11 trillion of U.S. debt instruments. So this creates vulnerability, latent fragility, a future crisis of confidence in the dollar, and dollar financial claims cannot be ruled out with those types of numbers. We've already seen market yields. They've begun to move higher. Hedging costs are rising. And I believe we're seeing early indications of de-risking and deleveraging. At the same time, we still see significant QE coming from the Bank of Japan and still from the ECB. This QE helps offset the liquidity impact of what is likely so far only modest speculative deleveraging. But if this deleveraging gains momentum as QE subsides, the impact on long-term yields could prove more dramatic and problematic. Waning liquidity always exposes dilemmas. That's just the way it works. It's the old Warren Buffett adage. You find out who's not wearing a swimming suit when the tide goes out. And I'll add, the longer the cycle, the greater the number of obese skinny dippers lurking below the surface.
Thank you for that. Or maybe not thank you for that. I don't know how I'm going to remove that from my mind.
I couldn't pass that on.
I know. Well, some have said that the U.S. government can use inflation to wipe out its $20, now $21 trillion in debt. That'd be fine if most of the debt was in 10 to 30-year bonds, but wouldn't higher inflation lead to immediately higher interest rates, which in turn would mean drastically higher annual debt service costs, thereby short-circuiting any attempt to inflate away the debt?
Yeah, this is such a key issue. At this point, it basically goes without debate that governments can inflate away debt problems. After all, they've been doing this now for the past 30 to 40 years. The question is, can it continue? And there are a number of problems in this regard that I don't think are well appreciated at all. For one, and this is very important, central banks don't control a general price level. It's kind of a myth that they can go out and manipulate a general price level. For starters, think of the digitalized economy. We had profound changes in the nature and capacity to increase the supply of output. This changes the dynamic for consumer price inflation. Central bankers can spur monetary inflation, yet this inflation goes primarily into asset markets. We've seen this now for how many years? And what does this do? It inflates problematic bubbles. In the meantime, unprecedented loose finance internationally spurs overinvestment in China. We've seen it in Asia and elsewhere. And this dynamic puts downward pressure on many consumer prices. Here at home, loose finance spurred the shale revolution and all this investment in alternative energy technologies, putting some downward pressure on energy prices. So-called globalization worked wonders in moderating consumer price inflation in the face of massive central bank stimulus, but now we see the downside with this rise of tariffs and protectionism, along with the massive government deficit spending. We're seeing recently that inflation has bottomed and has started to creep higher. And when this global bubble bursts, we could easily see a scenario with not only enormous deficits, but also stubborn inflation dynamics. And that's a very problematic scenario for deficits and debt service costs. It's just difficult for me not to be very pessimistic when it comes to U.S. government finances, unfortunately. Rapidly expanding debt will outgrow inflation, and I think the myth will finally be exposed.
Next question is, within the tactical short, is there a framework to set up trades asymmetrically that pay off big when you think that, when Doug, you think it's right, but risk only limited capital if the bull market resumes?
Sure, and there is a strategy where you can buy long-dated puts, buy leaps and things. It's always good to have those targeted. And we may consider that type of an offering, a strategic focus primarily on long-dated puts. At some point, we could consider that. That's a difficult strategy. Timing is everything. Also, that particular type of a strategy doesn't work as well as an effective hedge, because if the market continues to rally significantly, your puts can be so far out of the money that the market would have to drop a dramatic percent before you would start to generate good returns. So that's not a very effective hedge against the rest of one's risk portfolio. But anyway, it is something that we will be considering.
And the next question, I've always approached derivatives with the mantra that the market can remain irrational a lot longer than I can remain solvent. Thus, timing is everything. I'll allow the Big Short or Paulson, who was lucky in his timing of the market for CDOs and mortgage-backed securities, et cetera, but not so much on his big bet on gold. How do you account for this in your strategy? Is there a methodology to reduce the risk of being wrong on the bet by simply being too early?
Yeah, I agree completely with the premise of the question, and it's a really important issue. I'll throw in one of my favorite sayings. It comes from my experience also. Bubbles tend to go to unimaginable extremes and then double. So I've learned to presume that bubbles last much longer than we bubble analysts would expect. I also know from experience market topping processes, they can unfold over an extended period. It can be very difficult. So this is fundamental to our risk management focus and how we're managing short exposure today. We carefully manage overall exposure. And even more importantly, we're very disciplined with the composition of our short exposure. I refer to it as strategic beta analysis management, which is essentially managing risk based on the underlying market environment. And that's very important for today. Currently, for example, with the acute volatility and uncertainty, what I believe is a topping process, we are extra diligent with risk management. And an important part of our investment process, our methodology, is we impose risk control on losing positions. We don't allow big losers. We add to winners, cut the losers. We also look to reduce exposure when we're losing money.
And I think you've addressed this already, but the hedge strategy, the short strategy, is it a hedging program that uses put options?
Listed put options are a tool in our toolkit. There are many times when put options may play an important role in our overall market exposure. I've traded options now for 25 years, and I have the gray hair to prove it. These are attractive in theory, right? They have attractive risk characteristics in that they limit potential losses. But candidly, options generally work better in theory than they do in practice. They tend to be very challenging instruments to use effectively. My philosophy is to be very disciplined with options. Many like to buy puts when they're cheap, and they've been cheap for a while. My philosophy is to be very disciplined and not to buy them when they're cheap, but to buy them when I see a reasonably high probability of a catalyst. And I tend to also want to reach out for more time to buy somewhat longer dated options, assuming things will take longer to unfold than I would expect. So I generally avoid short-term options whose value is at the whim of, at least today, a rather forgiving marketplace when it comes to put options.
Well, and I think it's also important to remember how easy it is to move a market in the context of days or weeks. You know, we have options expiration this week, maintaining a positive bias in equities through the end of the week. That kind of market behavior is pretty common. So you can be right on a fundamental call, and if someone else has more buying power than you do, they can maintain market levels that leave your options expiring worthless. That kind of short-term interventionism is all too common in the options market. The next question, do you think 10-year rates will continue to rise? If so, is that what is going to break the bubble? After some bank failure, 10 years may or may not fall, but until then, is it going to rise?
Yeah, I believe 10-year yields are going higher. Today, bonds were under pressure again. And again, that 3% bogey in the 10-year Treasury is not far away now. We also see, you know, inflationary pressures are building, the Fed's moving more decisively towards normalization, and there is this massive, and it appears, unending supply of government debt in the pipeline. Then we have the safe haven bid in Treasuries, though. It could return if all of a sudden we see heightened systemic risk. We have to be aware of that, and that would be almost a normal development. So, you know, I believe 10-year Treasury yields remain depressed in the current environment because the bond market is sniffing out trouble in the, you know, in the risk markets down the horizon there. We saw this dynamic in 2007 and other periods, the old Greenspan conundrum. To me, it was never much of a mystery. You know, long-term Treasury yields, they're keen to bubble risk. The probability that within a, you know, a limited number of years, the bubble will burst and the Fed will come with lower rates and likely resort to more QE. And the problem is, and again, we saw this in 07, the bond market sniffing out trouble works to keep market yields low enough to extend late cycle bubble excess. So I think yields are going up. They could easily, Treasury yields could reverse and go lower in a risk-off environment, and we could just see, real extraordinary volatility in the Treasury market, I think.
Next question says, I remember Trichet getting frustrated with Bernanke when the ECB raised interest rates in 2012 and the Fed backed off raising rates. This caused Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain to run into trouble. Is the current trade war about forcing the ECB and China to raise their interest rates? First part of the question, I understand China's only raising it by 5 basis points at a time. Bank of Japan and ECB are probably speculating the Fed might stop raising rates sometime soon.
Yeah, I believe the issue with Trichet, that goes back to the ECB's controversial rate increase back in 2008. The Fed was in the easing mode then, but at the same time, crude had surged to $140 a barrel and inflation risk was percolating. So the ECB stepped up and raised rates, and they were criticized for it. But anyway, the financial crisis in the U.S. sparked the de-risking, deleveraging, which exposed all the excesses in Greece in particular, in the periphery in Europe. And that bursting of the Greece bubble put pressure on Portugal, Italy, and Spain and became the full-fledged crisis in 2011, 2012. Not coincidentally, that's when the Fed was preparing its so-called exit strategy from QE. In 2012, the ECB President Draghi desperately resorted to whatever it takes. And in tandem with the Bank of Japan and Fed and others, and, you know, the rest is history. I don't think the Fed has a lot of expectations for these other central banks to raise rates much. I think a lot of these central banks now are more focused on domestic policymaking.
You know, it impresses me, Doug, you know, the framework has been laid out in your Scandinavian countries, in Europe, and we've flirted with the zero bound. There are certain scenarios in which, you know, closure of the financial system and more financial repression via negative rates are not entirely out of the question. They've exercised that and sort of gotten the machinery in place. Michael Woodford at Columbia University and Ken Rogoff are still advocates for getting rates to the negative. In nominal terms, so that they can goose the economy, just as one more tool in the toolkit. So, I mean, it presumes a lot about their control of the markets and interest rates, but that's what you get with PhDs, is quite a bit of presumption. The next question is, if the 1929-like event, I believe the payment system crisis actually happened in 1931 when the Fed raised rates as it happened, relieving itself of being a lender of last resort, were to happen, those events to happen, is your fund going to be protected from bank failures? And so keep that in mind. He's got a little addendum here. Gaining on shorting is one thing, but keeping it seems more important, as it appears client money being commingled everywhere, and with most funds seeming to be creditors to the banks. So maybe you could shed some light on that.
Sure, and excellent question. First of all, you know, we specifically chose to use a brokerage that's not involved in proprietary trading or manages a book of derivative exposure. So that's one of the keys right there. A brokerage is not part of a big diversified, you know, global financial business. We chose a brokerage with conservative risk-focused management. Again, that's imperative. This has been a long-term concern in practice. I've gone through a few cycles, and I've yet to experience an issue with a prime brokerage failure or counterparty problem. I specifically want to avoid all of that, and our analytical framework hopefully gives us a little bit of a heads up where to avoid. These are all types of risks that we focus on more than others in the marketplace. As far as the commingled funds, in an environment of rising systemic risk, we can do things. In particular, we can put our cash in T-bills, and you know, we will not have commingled funds. That's not a game that we would be willing to play.
The next question relates to the Federal Reserve's responsibility. Is it the Federal Reserve's responsibility to prepare the bond market for massive new issuance in order to fund government's ambitious spending plans, or to protect the dollar, or to maintain market stability? And if they cannot do all three, which do they choose?
Yeah, this is an area that I can get a little worked up about, but anyway, I'll try to stay calm. It's the responsibility of the Federal Reserve to maintain financial stability. The rest of this is more nebulous. Regrettably, the Fed equates rising market prices with stability. While they do this, they disregard all varieties of problematic excess, and that includes speculation, the leveraging, the market misperceptions, resource misallocation. So over the years, central banks have promised too much, and they've intervened in the markets too much and too often. All of this has nurtured a view that they'll do whatever it takes. They'll take rates to zero or lower if necessary. They'll monetize government, private sector debt if necessary. They'll maintain low market yields and high stock prices. They'll ensure liquidity abundance. They'll even ward off bear markets and recessions. The problem is that all these assurances, these promises, these guarantees, they've all spurred market excess and economic maladjustment. The perception that they can control everything has ensured a degree of deep financial and market, economic, all of this deep structural maladjustment that they will not be able to control when the bubble inevitably bursts. So I believe the overriding challenge for central bankers will come in the liquidity sphere. That will be their primary focus. During the next serious de-risking, deleveraging episode, I anticipate they will likely have to inject enormous amounts of liquidity. And that's just in order to accommodate deleveraging. It would not surprise me if this spooks long-term bonds and destabilizes currency markets and faltering risk markets. They'll hold the central bankers in hostage. So I think the days of them making everything right, those are winding down.
Now, this next question is I'm glad it was asked. Folks have read you on the Prudent Bear website and seen your credit bubble bulletin for years. This person says, I started reading in 2001. Their interest is, for historical research, where can they go to look at your articles and essays and reports in sort of an archival form?
Sure. I appreciate that. I was saddened to see prudentbear.com when they shut the site down. But I do have all of my archives going back to 1999, almost 20 years, and those are available at my blog, and that's creditbubblebulletin.blogspot.com.
Great. That's a question from a trader. And it's similar to the one we were talking about earlier about counterparty risk and the issues with proprietary trading. But he says, I had a trading account with Man Financial, which was purchased by MF Global. It happened later to MF Global. When the force majeure is declared on the dollar, it'll undoubtedly collapse debt and equity markets here in the U.S., and crash markets globally. As a trader, my concern is over the network of brokerage firms handling all the trades. They could all go bust. Do you think it's a legitimate concern, or am I overly concerned? What are your thoughts on that in consideration that a short portfolio has to hypothecate their shares to participate, or are you using futures? And if using the latter, how do you feel about counterparty risk with futures or options contracts? Did you get all that done?
I'm scratching down notes here quickly. What a nightmare that must have been. I believe we're heading towards a more challenging financial crisis than 2008. So I think all such concerns are legitimate. So specifically in regard to shorting, we borrow shares instead of lending them. So I don't worry about lending securities and then not being able to get them back. That's not an issue for us. In 2008, regulators banned the shorting of financial stocks. So in certain environments, we have to be mindful of trading halts and restrictions on shorting, and that can impact our trading. Because of the complexity of contemporary securities and derivatives markets, though, I think a total ban on shorting would be extremely problematic for the markets. It likely would only occur after a crash. And at such a point, our focus would be on protecting our cash. I would expect at that point we'd be owning short-term treasuries. I'm always mindful of counterparty risk. For years, I've avoided third-party derivatives. Haven't had an issue with that. We will use ETFs instead of futures contracts. We'll purchase liquid listed put options. But these must be managed diligently in a crisis environment. What does that mean? That means a disciplined approach to taking profits. I call it extracting cash. Take money out of deepen the money puts, roll our strikes lower to reduce our risk when practical. We will extend maturities. The amount of option market value must be monitored and managed prudently, especially in a crisis type environment.
And the next one is, what do you think of that flat yield curve?
The flat yield curve, well, you know, as I mentioned previously, I think the flat yield curve is a long end, recognizing that risk of faltering markets is high, that there over the coming few years, there is a significant risk of a bursting bubble. So I think we're getting closer. How close is an open question. Right now, lower market yields are lending support to the risk markets, and these markets are supporting economic growth and with its central bank policy normalization. We saw in 2007 how the initial bout of volatility in the subprime issue led to a big rally in treasuries and agency debt, which prolonged the bubble for a bit of time, but in the end only made it worse. So all of these types of dynamics, the market instability creates great uncertainty. The wild volatility, in my mind, it's indicating that we're very late in this market cycle.
And, this will be the last question, and then we'll wrap up. But not long ago, I was speaking with an introducing broker, this questioner asks, and discovered that the European currency trading firms have been forced to reduce trade leverage to lower levels. Looks a lot like they're preparing for something. Any thoughts?
Well, they should be preparing for something. They're not oblivious to the potential instability associated with curtailing QE and beginning the move towards a more normalized policy regime. Especially the periphery Italian yields could be one of the most overvalued fixed income instruments in history. So of course they would be battening down the hatches. So far the market's cooperated with them, but we saw today, the rise in U.S. yields also transmitted to a rise in periphery yields in Europe. So maybe they're not that far away from instability over there as well.
Well, Doug, as we wrap, just some general observations. As we talk to business professionals, asset managers, and those with the fiduciary responsibility, over and over again, we keep on getting feedback like this. We had our 100-year flood in 2008, and it's done. We've got 100 years of peace and prosperity ahead of us. Having logged one of the greatest financial crises in 100 years, how can we expect to see something like that happen again? That's one thing that we keep on finding is you certainly are not going to have lightning strike twice, not that soon. Another observation is that, we probably are in somewhere between the eighth and ninth inning of the game, but we still have time. And while we have momentum, we're going to keep the positions in our portfolios as they are, which is based on a presumption that they can and will have time to react. Off the cuff, do you have any thoughts on that notion of being, up to the wire in terms of having a portfolio hedge in place? Or would you agree with sort of the proverbial better to be 3 months early than a day late?
Well, we've seen a number of flash crashes. We saw the market instability in February. I think when this unfolds, it could unfold rapidly, abruptly. Most people will not be prepared to de-risk. They won't have good viable options to hedge their market risk. So as we say, David, it's time to take this seriously and to get ready with a strategy to preserve capital, hedge our risk, and prepare for a changing market environment.
Well, I would encourage anyone listening, if you'd like to set up a time to visit with either one of us, Doug or myself, we'd be happy to do that over the next few weeks, and on a consultative basis, figure out what risks you're trying to hedge and what the appropriate way to do that would be, if the tactical short is a fit for you to the degree that it might be or not. We love what we do, and we love helping people. So please take us up on the offer of spending a few minutes to look and see, visit with someone on our team to see if this is the right fit for you. And appreciate your time today on the conference call. Look forward to any questions. If you feel we've missed something or this stirs further questions, feel free to send those by email, and we'll either respond by email, or if you'll provide us with a direct number, we'll give you a call back and schedule something for the next week or so we can fully explore that. Thanks for joining us. Here we finished our first year for the tactical short, full year's management, in the context of 10 years of asset management in the current form and 46 years in helping people hedge portfolio risk. So we appreciate the time you took today. Please make it a priority to continue the conversation and see where you can and should be hedging. Thanks for time today. Doug, thanks for joining. And we'll look forward to the next quarterly conference call in a quarter's time.
Thanks, David. Thanks, everyone, and good luck out there. Take care.